They would go north, where Ibarra and his dark friends would not find them. There the prophet could rebuild. He had stayed with Ibarra only because his followers had been strong enough to keep Ibarra's dark friends away. His dear followers. Brave men and true every one. Killed by dark friends. He mourned them, bowing his head and muttering a prayer. His followers joined him. They were weary, but the light of zeal shone in their eyes. Any who were weak or who lacked dedication had fled or been killed long ago. These were the best, the mightiest, the most faithful. Each one had killed many dark friends in the name of the dragon reborn. With them he could rebuild. But first he had to escape Ibarra. The prophet was too weak now to face him. But later he would kill him. Yes. Fingers on that neck, yes. The prophet could remember a time when he'd been called something else. Massima. Those days were growing very blurry to him, like memories from a former life. Indeed, just as all men were reborn into the pattern, so Massima had been reborn. He had cast off his old profane life and had become the prophet. The last of his followers joined him atop the cliff face. He spat at their feet. They had failed him. Cowards. They should have fought better. He should have been able to win that city. He turned north and pushed his way forward. This landscape was growing familiar to him, though they had nothing like it up in the borderlands. They would climb to the highlands, then cross over and enter Almuth Plain. There were dragons sworn there, followers of the prophet, even if many didn't know of him. There he could rebuild quickly. He pushed through a patch of the dark brush and entered a small clearing. His men followed quickly. They would need food soon, and he would have to send them hunting. No fires. They couldn't afford to alert.
"Hello, Massima," a quiet voice said.
He hissed, spinning, his followers bunching around him and pulling out weapons. Swords for some, knives, quarterstaffs, and the occasional polearm. The prophet scanned the dim afternoon clearing, searching for the one who had spoken. He found her standing on a little outcrop of rock a short distance away, a woman with a prominent Saldaean nose, slightly tilted eyes, and shoulder-length black hair. She wore green, with skirts divided for riding, her arms folded in front of her. Fael Ibarra, wife of the shadow-spawn Perrin Ibarra.
"Take her!"
the prophet screamed, pointing. Several of his followers scrambled forward, but most hesitated. They had seen what he had not. Shadows in the forest behind Ibarra's wife, a half-circle of them. They were the shapes of men, with bows pointed into the clearing. Fael waved with a sharp motion and the arrows flew. Those of his followers who had run at his bidding fell first, crying out in the silent forest before falling to the loamy earth. The prophet bellowed, each arrow seeming to pierce his own heart. His beloved followers, his friends, his dear brothers. An arrow slammed into him, throwing him backward to the ground. Around him, men died, just as they had earlier. Why? Why hadn't the dragon protected them? Why? Suddenly the horror of it all returned to him, the sinking terror of watching his men fall in waves, at watching them die at the hands of those dark friend Aiel. It was Perrin Ibarra's fault. If only the prophet had seen earlier, back in the early days before he'd even recognized the Lord Dragon for who he was.
"It's my fault," the prophet whispered as the last of his followers died.
It had taken several arrows to stop some of them. That made him proud. Slowly he forced himself back to his feet, hand to his shoulder, where the shaft sprouted. He'd lost too much blood. Dizzy, he fell to his knees. Fael stepped down off her stone and entered the clearing. Two women wearing trousers followed. They looked concerned, but Fael ignored their protests that she stay back. She walked right up to the prophet, then slid her knife from her belt. It was a fine blade, with a cast hilt that showed a wolf's head. That was well.
Looking at it, the prophet remembered the day when he'd earned his own blade, the day his father had given it to him.
"Thank you for helping to assault Mulden, Massima," Fail said, stopping right in front of him.
Then she reached up and rammed that knife into his heart. He fell backward, his own blood hot on his chest.
"Sometimes a wife must do what her husband cannot," he heard Fail tell her women as his eyes fluttered, trying to close. "It is a dark thing we did this day, but necessary. Let no one speak of it to my husband. He must never know."
Her voice grew distant. The prophet fell. Massima. That had been his name. He'd earned his sword on his 15th birthday. His father had been so proud.
"It's over then," he thought, unable to keep his eyes open.
He closed them, falling as if through an endless void.
"Did I do well, father? Or did I fail?"
There was no answer. And he joined with the void, tumbling into an endless sea of blackness. Chapter 1. Tears from Steel. The wheel of time turns, and ages come and pass, leaving memories that become legend. Legend fades to myth, and even myth is long forgotten when the age that gave it birth comes again. In one age, called the Third Age by some, an age yet to come, an age long past, a wind rose around the alabaster spire known as the White Tower. The wind was not the beginning. There are neither beginnings nor endings to the turning of the Wheel of Time. But it was a beginning. The wind twisted around the magnificent tower, brushing perfectly fitted stones and flapping majestic banners. The structure was somehow both graceful and powerful at the same time. A metaphor, perhaps, for those who had inhabited it for over 3,000 years. Few looking upon the tower would guess that at its heart, it had been both broken and corrupted. Separately. The wind blew, passing through a city that seemed more a work of art than a workaday capital. Each building was a marvel. Even the simple granite shopfronts had been crafted by meticulous ogier hands to evoke wonder and beauty. Here a dome hinted at the form of a rising sun. There a fountain sprang from the top of a building itself, cresting what appeared to be two waves crashing together. On one cobbled street, a pair of steep three-story buildings stood opposite one another, each crafted into the form of a maiden. The marble creations, half-statue, half-dwelling, reached with stone hands toward one another as if in greeting, hair billowing behind, immobile, yet carved with such delicacy that every strand seemed to undulate in the wind's passing. The streets themselves were far less grand. Oh, they had been laid out with care, radiating from the White Tower like streaks of sunlight. Yet that sunlight was dimmed by refuse and clutter, hints at the crowding the siege had caused. And perhaps the crowding wasn't the only reason for the disrepair. The storefront signs and awnings hadn't seen wash or polish in far too long. Rotting garbage piled where it had been dumped in alleys, drawing flies and rats but driving away all others. Dangerous toughs lounged on the street corners. Once they'd never have dared do that, and certainly not with such arrogance. Where was the White Tower? The law? Young fools laughed, saying that the city's troubles were the fault of the siege, and that things would settle down once the rebels were quelled. Older men shook their gray-streaked heads and muttered that things had never been this bad, even when the savage Aiel had besieged Tarvalen some 20 years previously. Merchants ignored both young and old. They had their own problems, mainly on South Harbor, where trade into the city by way of the river had nearly come to a halt. Thick-chested workers toiled beneath the eyes of an Aes Sedai, wearing a red-fringed shawl. She used the one power to remove wards and weaken the stone, while the workmen broke the rock apart and hauled it away. The workmen had sleeves rolled up, exposing curls of dark hair along burly arms, as they swung pick or hammer, pounding at the ancient stones. They dripped sweat onto rock or into the water below as they dug at the roots of the chain that blocked passage into the city by river. Half of that chain was now indestructible Quendiyar, called Heartstone by some. The effort to tear it free and allow passage into the city was an exhausting one. The harbor stoneworks, magnificent and strong, shaped by the power itself, were only one of the more visible casualties of the silent war between the rebel Aes Sedai and those who held the tower. The wind blew through the harbor, where idling porters stood watching the workers chip the stones away one by one, sending flakes of gray-white dust afloat on the water. Those with too much sense, or perhaps too little, whispered that such portents could mean only one thing. Tarmon Gaiden, the last battle, must quickly be approaching. The wind danced away from the docks, passing over the tall white bulwarks, known as the Shining Walls. Here at least one could find cleanliness and attention in the tower guard who stood watch, holding bows. Clean-shaven, wearing white tabards free from stain or wear, the archers watched over their barricades with the dangerous readiness of snakes prepared to strike. These soldiers had no intention of letting Tarvalin fall while they were on duty. Tarvalin had repelled every enemy. Trollocs had breached the walls, but been defeated in the city. Arthur Hawkwing had failed to take Tarvalin. Even the black-veiled Aiel, who had ravaged the land during the Aiel War, had never taken the city. Many claimed this as a great victory. Others wondered what would have happened if the Aiel had actually wanted to cross into the city. The wind passed over the western fork of the River Aranin, leaving the island of Tarvalin behind, passing the Alandair Bridge, soaring high to the right, as if taunting enemies to cross it and die. Past the bridge, the wind swept into Alandair, one of the many villages near Tarvalin. It was a village mostly depopulated, as families had fled across the bridge for refuge in the city. The enemy army had appeared suddenly, without warning, as if brought by a blizzard. Few wondered at it. This rebel army was headed by Aes Sedai, and those who lived in the White Tower's shadow rarely gambled on just what Aes Sedai could and couldn't do. The rebel army was poised, but uncertain. Over 50,000 strong had camped in a massive ring of tents around the smaller camp of Aes Sedai. There was a tight perimeter between the inner camp and the outer one, a perimeter that had been most recently been intended to exclude men, particularly those who could wield Saidin. Almost, one could think, that this camp of rebels intended to set up permanently. It had an air of common daily life about its workings. Figures in white bustled about, some wearing formal novice dresses, many others clothed in near approximations. Looking closely, one could see that many of these were far from young. Some had already reached their graying. But they were referred to as children, and obedient they were as they washed clothing, beat rugs, and scrubbed tents beneath the eyes of serene-faced Aes Sedai. And if those Aes Sedai glanced with uncommon frequency at the nail-like profile of the White Tower, one would be mistaken in assuming them uncomfortable or nervous. Aes Sedai were in control. Always. Even now, when they had suffered an indelible defeat, Egwene Alvir, the rebel Omerlin's seat, had been captured and imprisoned within the tower. The wind flicked a few dresses, knocked some laundry from its hangings, then continued westward in a rush. Westward past towering Dragon Mount, with its shattered and smoking apex. Over the black hills and across the sweeping Carolane grass. Here, pockets of sheltered snow clung to shadows beneath craggy overhangs, or beside the occasional stands of mountain blackwood. It was time for spring to arrive, time for new shoots to peek through the winter's thatch, and for buds to sprout on the thin-branched willows. Few of either had actually come. The land was still dormant, as if waiting, holding its breath. The unnatural heat of the previous autumn had stretched well into winter, pressing upon the land a drought that had baked the life from all but the most vigorous plants. When winter had finally arrived, it had come in a tempest of ice and snow,
a lingering, killing frost. Now that the cold had finally retreated, the scattered farmers looked in vain for hope. The wind swept across brown winter grass, shaking the trees' still barren branches. To the west, as it approached the land known as Arid-Daman, cresting hills and short peaks, something suddenly slammed against it. Something unseen. Something spawned by the distant darkness to the north. Something that flowed against the natural tide and currents of the air. The wind was consumed by it, blown southward in a gust, across low peaks and brown foothills, to a log manor house, isolated, set upon the pine-forested hills in eastern Arid-Daman. The wind blew across the manor house and the tents set up in the wide open field before it, rattling pine needles and shaking tents. Rand El-Thor, the dragon reborn, stood, hands behind his back as he looked out the open manor window. He still thought of them that way, his hands, though he now had only one. His left arm ended in a stump. He could feel the smooth, Sayadar-healed skin with the fingers of his good hand. Yet he felt as if his other hand should be there to touch. Steel, he thought. I am steel. This cannot be fixed, and so I move on. The building, a thick logged structure of pine and cedar, after a design favored by the Damani wealthy, groaned and settled in the wind. Something on that wind smelled of rotten meat. Not an uncommon scent these days. Meat spoiled without warning, sometimes only a few minutes after butchering. Drying it or salting it didn't help. It was the Dark One's touch, and it grew with each passing day. How long until it was as overwhelming, as oily and nauseating as the taint that had once coated Sayadin, the male half of the One Power? The room he stood in was wide and long, thick logs making up the outer wall. Planks of pine, still smelling faintly of sap and stain, made up the other walls. The room was furnished sparsely, fur rug on the floor, a pair of aged crossed swords above the hearth, furniture of wood with the bark left on in patches. The entire place had been decorated in a way to say that this was an idyllic home in the woods, away from the bustle of larger cities. Not a cabin, of course. It was far too large and lavish for that. A retreat.
Rand?
A soft voice asked. He didn't turn, but felt Min's fingers touch his arm. A moment later, her hands moved to his waist, and he felt her head rest upon his arm. He could feel her concern for him through the bond they shared. Steel, he thought.
I know you don't like, Min began.
The boughs, he said, nodding out the window. You see those pines, just to the side of Bashir's camp?
Yes, Rand, but...
They blow the wrong direction, Rand said. Min hesitated, and though she gave no physical reaction, the bond brought him her spike of alarm. Their window was on the upper floor of the manor, and outside of it, banners set above the camp flapped against themselves. The banner of light and the dragon banner for Rand, a much smaller blue flag bearing the three red king's penny blossoms to mark the presence of House Bashir. All three flew proud, yet just to the side of them, the needles on the pines blew in the opposite direction. The Dark One stirs, Min, Rand said. He could almost think these winds a result of his own Taviran nature, but the events he caused were always possible. The wind blowing in two directions at once? Well, he could feel the wrongness in the way those pines moved, even if he did have trouble distinguishing the individual needles. His eyesight hadn't been the same since the attack on that day he'd lost his hand. It was as if he looked through water at something distorted. It was getting better, slowly. This building was one in a long line of manors, estates, and other remote hiding places Rand had used during the last few weeks. He'd wanted to keep moving, jumping from location to location, following the failed meeting with Semirag. He'd wanted time to think, to consider, and hopefully time to confuse the enemies that might be searching for him. Lord Algorin's manor in Tyr had been compromised. A pity. That had been a good place to stay. But Rand had to keep moving. Below, Bashir's Saldaeans had set up a camp on the manor's green, the open patch of grass out front bounded by rows of fir and pine trees. Calling it the green seemed an irony these days. Even before the army's arrival, it hadn't been green. It had been a patchy brown, winter thatch broken only occasionally by hesitant new shoots. Those had been sickly and yellow, and they had now been trampled by hooves or booted feet. Tents covered the green. From Rand's vantage on the second floor, the neat lines of small peaked tents reminded him of squares on a stone's board. The soldiers had noticed the wind. Some pointed, others kept their heads down, polishing armor, carrying buckets of water to the horse lines, sharpening swords or lance points. At least it was not the dead walking again. The most firm-hearted of men could lose their will when spirits rose from their graves, and Rand needed his army to be strong. Need. No longer was it about what Rand wanted or what he wished. Everything he did focused only on need, and what he needed most was the lives of those who followed him. Soldiers to fight and to die, to prepare the world for the last battle. Tommen Gyton was coming. What he needed was for them all to be strong enough to win. To the far left of the green, running below the modest hill where the manor rested, a twisting stream cut the ground, sprouting with yellow stickfinger reeds and scrub oak that had yet to send out spring buds. A small waterway to be certain, but a fine source of fresh water for the army. Just outside the window, the winds suddenly righted themselves, and the flags whipped around, blowing in the other direction. So it hadn't been the needles, after all, but the banners that had been in the wrong. Min let out a soft sigh, and he could feel her relief, though she still worried about him. That emotion was perpetual lately. He felt it from all of them, each of the four bundles of emotions tucked away in the back of his mind. Three for the women he had allowed to place themselves there, one for the woman who had forced her way in against his will. One of them was drawing closer. Avienda, coming with Rourke, to meet with Rand at the manor house. Each of the four women would regret their decision to bond him. He wished he could regret his decision to let them, or at least his decision to allow the three he loved. But the truth was that he needed Min, needed her strength and her love. He would use her as he used so many others. No, there was no place in him for regret. He just wished he could banish guilt as easily.
Ilyena,
a voice said distantly in Rand's head.
My love.
Luz Theron Telamon, Kinslayer, was relatively quiet this day. Rand tried not to think too hard about the things Semirag had said on the day when Rand had lost his hand. She was one of the Forsaken. She would say anything if she thought it would bring her target pain.
She tortured an entire city to prove herself, Luz Theron whispered. She has killed 1,000 men 1,000 different ways to see how their screams would differ from one another. But she rarely lies. Rarely.
Rand pushed the voice away.
Rand,
Min said, softer than before. He turned to look at her. She was lithe and slight of build, and he often felt that he towered over her. She kept her hair in short ringlets, the collar dark, but not as dark as her deep, worried eyes. As always, she had chosen to wear a coat and trousers. Today, they were of a deep green, much like the needles on the pines outside. Yet, as if to contradict her tailored choice, she had had the outfit made to accentuate her figure. Silver embroidery in the shape of Bonnabel flowers ran around the cuffs, and lace peeked out from the sleeves underneath. She smelled faintly of lavender, perhaps from the soap she'd taken to most recently. Why wear trousers only to trim herself up with lace? Rand had long abandoned trying to understand women. Understanding them would not help him reach Sheol Ghul. Besides, He didn't need to understand women in order to use them, particularly if they had information he needed. He gritted his teeth. No, he thought. No, there are lines I will not cross. There are things even I will not do.
You're thinking about her again,
Min said, almost accusatory. He often wondered if there was such a thing as a bond that worked only one way. He would have given much for one of those.
Rand, she's one of the Forsaken, Min continued. She would have killed all of us without a second thought.
She wasn't intending to kill me, Rand said softly, turning away from Min and looking out the window again. Me she would have held. Min cringed. Pain, worry. She was thinking of the twisted male Adam that Semirag had brought, hidden, when she'd come impersonating the Daughter of the Nine Moons. The Forsaken's disguise had been disrupted by Cadswain's Tirangrial, allowing Rand to recognize Semirag, or at least allowing Luce Theron to recognize her. The exchange had ended with Rand losing a hand, but gaining one of the Forsaken as his prisoner. The last time he'd been in a similar situation, it hadn't ended well. He still didn't know where Asmodian had gone or why the weasel of a man had fled in the first place. But Rand did suspect that he had betrayed much about Rand's plans and activities.
Should have killed him. Should have killed them all.
Rand nodded, then froze. Had that been Luce Theron's thought or his own?
Luce Theron, Rand thought. Are you there?
He thought he heard laughter, or perhaps it was sobbing.
Burn you, Rand thought. Talk to me. The time is coming. I need to know what you know. How did you seal the Dark One's prison? What went wrong? And why did it leave the prison flawed? Speak to me.
Yes, that was definitely sobbing, not laughter. Sometimes it was hard to tell with Luce Theron. Rand continued to think of the dead man as a separate individual from himself, regardless of what Semirag had said. He had cleansed Sayadin. The taint was gone and it could touch his mind no longer. He was not going to go insane.
The descent into terminal madness can be abrupt.
He heard her words again, spoken for the others to hear. His secret was finally out. But Min had seen a viewing of Rand and another man melded together. Didn't that mean that he and Luce Theron were two separate people? Two individuals forced into one body?
It makes no difference that his voice is real, Semirag had said. In fact, it makes his situation worse.
Rand watched a particular group of six soldiers inspect the horse lines that ran along the right side of the green, between the last line of tents and the line of trees. They checked the hooves one at a time. Rand couldn't think about his madness. He also couldn't think about what Cadswain was doing with Semirag. That left only his plans.
The north and the east must be as one. The west and the south must be as one.
That was the answer he'd received from the strange creatures beyond the red stone doorway. It was all he had to go on. North and east. He had to force the lands into peace, whether they wanted it or not. He had a tenuous balance in the east, with Ilion, Mayen, Kyrian, and Tyr all under his control in one way or another. The Shonchan ruled in the south, with Altara, Amadisia, and Taraban under their control. Murundi might soon be theirs if they were pressing in that direction. That left Andor and Elaine. Elaine. She was distant, far to the east, but he could still feel her bundle of emotions in his head. At such a distance, it was difficult to tell much, but he thought she was relieved. Did that mean her struggle for power in Andor was going well? What of the armies that had besieged her? And what were those borderlanders up to? They had left their posts, joining together and marching south to find Rand, but giving no explanation of what they wanted of him. They were some of the best soldiers west of the Spine of the World.
Their help would be invaluable at the last battle, but they had left the Northlands. Why? He was loath to confront them, however, for fear it could mean yet another fight, one he couldn't afford at the moment. Light. He would have thought that of all people he could have depended on the Borderlanders to support him against the Shadow. No matter. Not for the moment. He had peace, or something close to it, in most of the land. He tried not to think about the recently placated rebellion against him in Tyr, or the volatility of the borders with Seanchan lands, or the plottings of the nobility in Kyrian. Every time he thought he had a nation secure, it seemed a dozen others fell apart. How could he bring peace to a people who refused to accept it? Min's fingers tightened on his arm, and he took a deep breath. He did what he could, and for now he had two goals. Peace in Arad-Daman, and a truce with the Seanchan. The words he'd received beyond the doorway were now clear. He could not fight both the Seanchan and the Dark One. He had to keep the Seanchan from advancing until the last battle was over. After that, the light could burn them all. Why had the Seanchan ignored his requests for a meeting? Were they angered that he had captured Semirag? He had let the Suldam go free. Did that not speak of his good faith? Arad-Daman would prove his intentions. If he could end the fight in Elmoth Plain, he could show the Seanchan that he was serious in his pursuits for peace. He would make them see. Rand took a deep breath, studying out the window. Bashir's 8,000 soldiers were erecting peaked tents and digging an earthen moat and wall around the green. The growing bulwark of deep brown contrasted with the white tents. Rand had ordered the Ashaman to help with the digging, and though he doubted they enjoyed the humble work, it did speed the process greatly. Besides, Rand suspected that they, like he himself, secretly savored any excuse to hold Sayadin. He could see a small group of them in their stiff black coats, weaves spinning around them as they dug up another patch of ground. There were 10 of them in the camp, though only Flynn, Naif, and Narishma were full Ashaman. The Saldaeans worked quickly, wearing their short coats as they cared for their mounds and set pickets. Others took shovelfuls of dirt from the Ashaman mound and used it to pack into the bulwark. Rand could see that there was that displeasure on the faces of many of the hawk-nosed Saldaeans. They didn't like making camp in a wooded area, even one as sparsely flecked with pine as this hillside. Trees made cavalry charges difficult, and could hide enemies as they approached. Davram Bashir himself rode slowly through the camp, barking orders through that thick mustache of his. Beside him walked Lord Talayan, a portly man in a long coat and wearing a thin Domani mustache. He was an acquaintance of Bashir's. Lord Talayan put himself at risk by housing Rand. Sheltering the troops of the Dragon Reborn could be seen as treason. But who was there to punish him? Arad-Daman was in chaos, the throne under threat from several rebel factions. And then there was the great Domani general Rodal Iteralda, and his surprisingly effective war against the Seanchan to the south. Like his men, Bashir went about unarmored in a short blue coat. He also wore a pair of the baggy trousers that he favored, the bottoms tucked into his knee-high boots. What did Bashir think of being caught in Rand's Tabirin web? In being, if not in direct opposition to the will of his queen, at least uncomfortably to the side of it. How long had it been since he had reported to his rightful ruler? Hadn't he promised Rand that his queen's support would be speedy in coming? How many months ago had that been? I am the Dragon Reborn, Rand thought. I break all covenants and vows. Old allegiances are unimportant. Only Tarmon Gaiden matters. Tarmon Gaiden, and the servants of the Shadow. I wonder if we'll find Grendel here, Rand said thoughtfully. Grendel? Min asked. What makes you think she might be? Rand shook his head. Asmodian had said Grendel was in Arad-Daman, though that had been months ago. Was she still here? It seemed plausible. It was one of the few major nations where she could be. Grain Dahl liked to have a hidden base of power far from where the other Forsaken lurked. She wouldn't have set up in Andor, Tyr, or Ilion. Nor would she have been caught in the lands to the southwest, not with the Shonshan invasion. She would have a hidden retreat somewhere. That was how she operated. Probably in the mountains, secluded, somewhere here in the north. He couldn't be sure she was in Ar-Adamon, though it felt right to him from what he knew of her, from what Luz Theron knew of her. But it was only a possibility. He would be careful watching for her. Each of the Forsaken that he removed would make the last battle that much easier to fight. It would... Soft footsteps approached his closed door. Rand released Min, and they both spun, Rand reaching for his sword. A useless gesture now. The loss of his hand, though it wasn't his primary sword hand, would leave him vulnerable if he were to face a skilled opponent. Even with Sayadin to provide a far more potent weapon, his first instinct was for the sword. He'd have to change that. It might get him killed someday. The door opened, and Cad Swain strode in, as confident as any queen at court. She was a handsome woman, with dark eyes and an angular face. Her dark gray hair was up in a bun, a dozen tiny golden ornaments, each one a Tirangrial or Angrial, hanging in their places atop it. Her dress was of a simple, thick wool, tied at the waist with a yellow belt, with more yellow embroidery across the collar. The dress itself was green, which was not uncommon, as that was her Aja. Rand sometimes felt that her stern face, ageless like that of any Aes Sedai who had worked long enough with the power, would have fit better in the red Aja. He relaxed his hand on his sword, though he did not release it. He fingered the cloth-tied hilt. The weapon was long, slightly curved, and the lacquered scabbard was painted with a long, sinuous dragon of red and gold. It looked as if it had been designed specially for Rand, and yet it was centuries old, unearthed only recently. How odd that they should find this now, he thought, and make a gift of it to me, completely unaware of what they were holding. He had taken to wearing the sword immediately. It felt right beneath his fingers. He had told no one, not even Min, that he had recognized the weapon. And not, oddly, from Luz Theron's memories, but from Rand's own. Cad Swain was accompanied by several others. Nynaeve was expected. She often followed Cad Swain these days, like a rival cat she found encroaching on her territory. She did it for him, likely. The dark-haired Aes Sedai had never quite given up being Wisdom of Emmons Field, no matter what she said, and she gave no quarter to anyone she thought was abusing one under her protection. Unless, of course, Nynaeve herself was the one doing the abusing. Today she wore a dress of gray with a yellow slash at the waist over her belt, a new Domani fashion, he had heard, and had the customary red dot on her forehead. She wore a long gold necklace and slim gold belt with matching bracelets and finger rings, both studded with large red, green, and blue gems. The jewelry was a Tirangrial, or rather several of them, and an Angrial, too, comparable to what Cad Swain wore. Rand had occasionally heard Nynaeve muttering that her Tirangrial, with the gaudy gems, were impossible to match to her clothing. When Nynaeve wasn't a surprise, Alivia was. Rand hadn't been aware that the former Domani had been involved in the information gathering. Still, she was supposed to be even stronger than Nynaeve in the One Power, so perhaps she had been brought for support. One could never be too careful where the Forsaken were concerned. There were streaks of white in Olivia's hair, and she was just a bit taller than Nynaeve. That white in her hair was telling. Any white or gray on a woman who wielded the One Power meant age. A great deal of it. Olivia claimed to be 4 centuries old. Today, the former Domani wore a strikingly red dress, as if in an attempt to be confrontational. Most Domani, once unleashed, remained timid. Not so with Olivia. There was an intensity to her that almost suggested a white cloak. He felt Min stiffen, and he felt her displeasure. Olivia would help Rand die eventually. That had been one of Min's viewings, and Min's viewings were never wrong. Except that she'd said she'd been wrong about Moraine. Perhaps that meant that he wouldn't have to. No. Anything that made him think of living through the last battle, anything that made him hope, was dangerous. He had to be hard enough to accept what was coming to him. Hard enough to die when the time came.
You said we could die, Luce Theron said in the back of his mind. You promised.
Cadswain said nothing as she walked across the room, helping herself to a cup of the spiced wine that sat on a small serving table beside the bed. Then she sat down in one of the red cedar chairs. At least she hadn't demanded that he pour the wine for her. That sort of thing wasn't beyond her.
Well, what did you learn? He asked, walking from the window and pouring himself a cup of wine as well.
Min walked to the bed, with its frame of cedar logs and a skip-peeled headboard, stained deeply reddish-brown, and sat down, hands in her lap. She watched Olivia carefully. Cadswain raised an eyebrow at the sharpness in Rand's voice. He sighed, forcing down his annoyance. He had asked her to be his counselor, and he had agreed to her stipulations. Min said there was something important he would need to learn from Cadswain. That was another viewing. And in truth, he had found her advice useful on more than one occasion. She was worth her constant demands for decorum.
How did the questioning go, Cadswain Sedai? He asked in a more moderate tone.
She smiled to herself.
Well enough.
Well enough,
Nynaeve snapped. She had made no promises to Cadswain about civility.
That woman is infuriating!
Cadswain sipped her wine.
I wonder what else one could expect from one of the Forsaken child. She has had a great deal of time to practice being infuriating.
Rand, that creature is a stone,
Nynaeve said, turning to him.
She's yielded barely a single useful sentence despite days of questioning. All she does is explain how inferior and backward we are, with the occasional aside that she's eventually going to kill us all.
Nynaeve reached up to her long single braid, but stopped herself short of tugging on it. She was getting better about that. Rand wondered why she bothered, considering how obvious her temper was.
For all the girl's dramatic talk, Cadswain said, nodding to Nynaeve, she has a reasonable grasp on the situation. Fah. When I said well enough, you were to interpret it as well as you might expect, given our unfortunate constraints. One cannot blindfold an artist, then be surprised when he has nothing to paint.
This isn't art, Cadswain, Rand said dryly. It's torture. Min shared a glance with him, and he felt her concern. Concern for him? He wasn't the one being tortured.
The box, Luz Theron whispered. We should have died in the box. Then it would be over.
Cadswain sipped her wine. Rand hadn't tasted his. He already knew that the spices were so strong as to render the drink unpalatable. Better that than the alternative.
You press us for results, boy, Cadswain said, and yet you deny us the tools we need to get them. Whether you name it torture, questioning, or baking, I call it foolishness. Now, if we were allowed to—
No,
Rand growled, waving a hand, a stump, at her.
You will not threaten or hurt her.
Time spent in a dark box, being pulled forth and being beaten repeatedly.
He would not have a woman in his power treated the same way. Not even one of the Forsaken.
You may question her, but some things I will not allow.
Nynaeve sniffed.
Rand, she's one of the Forsaken. Dangerous beyond reason.
I am aware of the threat, Rand said flatly, holding up the stump where his left hand had been.
The metallic gold and red tattoo of a dragon's body sparkled in the lamplight. Its head had been consumed in the fire that had nearly killed him. Nynaeve took a deep breath.
Yes, well, then you must see that normal rules shouldn't apply to her.
I said no, Rand said. You will question her, but you will not hurt her.
Not a woman. I will keep to this one shred of light inside me. I've caused the deaths and sorrows of too many women already.
"If that is what you demand, boy," Cadswain said tersely, "then that is what shall be done. Just don't whine when we are unable to drag out of her what she had for breakfast yesterday, let alone the locations of the other Forsaken. One begins to wonder why you insist we continue this farce at all. Perhaps we should simply turn her over to the White Tower and be done with it."
Rand turned away. Outside, the soldiers had finished with the horse lines. They looked good. Even and straight, the animals given just the right amount of slack. Turn her over to the White Tower? That would never happen. Cadswain wouldn't let Semirog out of her grip until she got the answers she wanted. The wind still blew outside, his own banners flapping before his eyes. "Turn her over to the White Tower, you say," he said, glancing back into the room. "Which White Tower? Would you entrust her to Elida? Or did you mean the others? I doubt that Egwene would be pleased if I dropped one of the Forsaken in her lap. Egwene might just let Semirog go and take me captive instead. Force me to kneel before the White Tower's justice and gentle me just to give her another notch in her belt." Nynaeve frowned.
"Rand, Egwene would never—"
"She's Amarlin," he said, downing his cup of wine in one gulp. It was as putrid as he recalled. "Aes Sedai to the core. I'm just another pawn to her."
"Yes," Luz Theron said. "We need to stay away from all of them. They refused to help us, you know. Refused. Said my plan was too reckless. That left me with only the 100 companions. No women to form a circle. Traitors. This is their fault.
But I'm the one who killed Ilyena. Why?"
Nynaeve said something, but Rand ignored her.
"Luz Theron," he said to the voice, "what was it you did? The women wouldn't help. Why?"
But Luz Theron had begun sobbing again, and his voice grew distant.
"Tell me," Rand yelled, throwing his cup down. "Burn you, Kinslayer, speak to me!"
The room fell silent. Rand blinked. He'd never tried speaking to Luz Theron out loud where others could hear. And they knew. Semirog had spoken of the voice that he heard, dismissing Rand as if he were a common madman. Rand reached up, running a hand through his hair. Or he tried to, but he used the arm that was only a stump, and it accomplished nothing.
"Light," he thought. "I'm losing control. Half the time I don't know which voice is mine and which is his. This was supposed to get better when I cleansed Zaydeen. I was supposed to be safe."
"Not safe,"
Luz Theron muttered.
"We were already mad. Can't turn back from that now."
He began to cackle, but the laughter turned to sobs. Rand looked around the room. Min's dark eyes were so worried he had to turn away. Olivia, who had watched the exchange about Semirog with those penetrating eyes of hers, seemed too knowing. Nynaeve finally gave in and tugged on her braid. For once, Cadswain didn't chastise him for his outburst. Instead, she just sipped her wine. How could she stand the stuff? The thought was trivial, ridiculous. He wanted to laugh. Only the sound wouldn't come out. He couldn't summon even a wry humor. Not anymore.
"Light, I can't keep this up. My eyes see as if in a fog. My hand is burned away and the old wounds in my side rip open if I do anything more strenuous than breathe. I'm dry, like an overused well. I need to finish my work here and get to Sheogul. Otherwise, there won't be anything left of me for the Dark One to kill."
That wasn't a thought to cause laughter. It was one to cause despair. But Rand did not weep, for tears could not come from steel. For the moment, Luz Theron's cries seemed enough for both of them.
Chapter 2. The Nature of Pain. Egwene stood up straight, backside aflame with the now familiar agony of a solid beating beneath the hands of the mistress of novices. She felt like a rug that had just been pounded free of its dust. Despite that, she calmly straightened her white skirts, then turned to the room's mirror and calmly dabbed the tears from the corners of her eyes. Only one tear in each eye this time. She smiled to her reflection, and her twin selves nodded to one another in satisfaction. A small, dark-paneled room reflected behind her on the mirror's silvery surface. Such a stern place it was. A sturdy stool in the corner, the top darkened and smoothed from years and years of use. A blockish desk, set with the Mistress of Novices' thick tome. The narrow table directly behind Egwene had some carvings, but its leather padding was far more distinctive. Many a novice, and not a few accepted, had bent down across that table, bearing the punishment for disobedience. Egwene could almost imagine that the table's dark color had come from repeated tear stains. Many of her own had been shed there. But none today. Only two tears, and neither had fallen from her cheeks. Not that she didn't hurt. Her entire body seemed to burn from the pain. Indeed, the severity of those beatings had increased the longer she continued to defy the powers in the White Tower. But as the beatings had grown more frequent and more painful, Egwene's resolve to endure had grown as well. She hadn't yet managed to embrace and accept the pain as the Aiel did, but she felt that she was close. The Aiel could laugh during the most cruel of tortures. Well, she could smile the moment she stood up. Each lash she endured, each pain she suffered, was a victory. And victory was always a reason for happiness, no matter how one's pride or one's skin burned. Standing beside the table behind Egwene, reflected in the mirror, was the Mistress of Novices herself. Sylviana looked down at the leather strap in her hands, frowning. Her ageless square face seemed just faintly confused. She regarded the strap as one might a knife that refused to cut, or a lamp that refused to light. The woman was of the red Aja, a fact reflected in the trim on the hem of her simple gray dress and the fringed shawl on her shoulders. She was tall and stocky, and she had her black hair back in a bun. In most ways, Egwene considered her a superior mistress of novices, even if she had administered a ridiculous number of punishments to Egwene. Perhaps because of that. Sylviana did her duty. Light knew there were few enough in the tower lately of whom that could be said. Sylviana looked up and met Egwene's eyes in the mirror. She quickly put down the strap and washed all emotion from her face. Egwene turned around calmly. Uncharacteristically, Sylviana sighed. "When will you give this up, child?" she asked. "You've proven your point quite admirably, I must say, but you must know that I will continue to punish you until you submit. Proper order must be maintained." Egwene held in her shock. The Mistress of Novices rarely addressed Egwene except to offer instruction or reprobation. Still, there had been cracks before. "Proper order, Sylviana?" Egwene asked. "As it has been maintained elsewhere in the tower?" Sylviana's lips drew back in a line. She turned and made a notation in her book. "I will see you in the morning. Off to dinner with you." The morning punishment would be because Egwene had called the Mistress of Novices by her name and without adding the honorific Sedai to the end, and likely because both knew that Egwene would not curtsy before she left. "I will return in the morning," Egwene said, "but dinner must wait. I have been ordered to attend Elida this evening as she eats." This session with Sylviana had gone long. Egwene had brought quite a list of infractions with her, and now she wouldn't have time to eat. Her stomach complained at the prospect. Sylviana showed just a brief moment of emotion. Was it surprise? "And you said nothing of this earlier? Would it have changed anything if I had?" Sylviana did not respond to the question. "You will eat after attending the Armelin, then. I shall leave instructions for the Mistress of the Kitchens to hold you some food. Considering how often you are being given healing these days, child, you will need to take your meals. I won't have you collapsing from lack of nourishment." Stern, yet fair. A pity this one had found her way to the red. "Very well," Egwene said. And after eating, Sylviana said, raising a finger, you shall return to me for showing disrespect to the Ammerlin seat. She is never to be known as simply Elida to you, child. She turned down to her ledger, adding, besides, light only knows what kind of trouble you'll be in by this evening. As Egwene left the small chamber behind, entering a wide, gray-stoned hallway with floor tiles of red and green, she considered that last comment. Perhaps it hadn't been surprise that Sylviana had shown upon hearing of Egwene's visit to Elida. Perhaps it had been sympathy. Elida would not react well when Egwene stood up to her the way she had to all others in the tower. Was that why Sylviana had decided to bring Egwene back for a final strapping after eating? With the orders Sylviana had given, Egwene would be required to take food before returning for her punishment, even if Elida heaped the strappings upon her. It was a small kindness, but Egwene was grateful for it. Enduring the daily punishments was difficult enough without skipping meals. As she pondered, two red sisters, Katarine and Barisine, approached her. Katarine held a brass cup, another dose of fork root. Elida wanted to make certain that Egwene couldn't channel a trickle during the meal, it seemed. Egwene took the cup without protesting and downed it in a single gulp, tasting the faint yet characteristic hint of mint. She handed the cup back to Katarine with an offhanded gesture, and the woman had no choice but to accept it, almost as if she were a royal cup-bearer. Egwene didn't head for Elida's quarters immediately. The overly long punishment's intrusion into the dinner hour ironically left her with a few spare moments, and she didn't want to arrive early, for that would show Elida deference. So instead she lingered outside the door of the Mistress of Novices with Katarine and Barisine. Would a certain figure come to visit the study? In the distance, small clusters of sisters walked the hallway's tiles of green and red. There was a furtive cast to their eyes, like hares venturing into a clearing to nibble at leaves, yet fearing the predator who hid in the shadows. Sisters in the tower these days always wore their shawls, and they never went about alone. Some even held the power, as if afraid of being jumped by footpads here in the White Tower itself. Are you pleased with this? Egwene found herself asking. She glanced at Katarine and Barisine. Both were, coincidentally, also part of the group that had first captured Egwene. What was that, child? Katarine asked coolly. Speaking to a sister without being asked a question first? Are you so eager for more punishment? She wore a conspicuous amount of red, her dress a bright crimson slashed with black, her dark hair curled slightly in its cascade down her back. Egwene ignored the threat. What more could they do to her? Set aside the bickering for a moment, Katarine, Egwene said, watching a group of yellows pass, their step quickening as they saw the two reds. Set aside the posturing for authority and the threats. Put these things away and look! Are you proud of this? The tower spent centuries without an Ammerlin being raised from the red. Now, when you finally have a chance, your chosen leader has done this to the tower. Women who won't meet the eyes of those they do not know familiarly. Sisters who travel in clusters. The Ajahs behave as if they are at war with one another. Katarine sniffed at the comment, though the lanky Barisine hesitated. Glancing over her shoulder at the group of yellows hurrying down the corridor, several of them firing glances back at the two reds. This was not caused by the Ammerlin, Katarine said. It was created by your foolish rebels and their betrayal. My rebels? Egwene thought with an inward smile. So you now see them as mine, rather than regarding me as just a poor accepted who was duped? That's progress. Were we the ones who pulled down a sitting Ammerlin? Egwene asked. Were we the ones who turned warder against warder? Or the ones who failed to contain the dragon reborn? Have we chosen an Ammerlin who is so power-hungry she's ordered the construction of her own palace? A woman who has every sister wondering if she'll be the next to be stripped of the shawl? Katarine didn't respond, as though realizing that she shouldn't be drawn into an argument with a mere novice. Barisine still watched the distant yellows, her eyes wide, worried. I should think, Egwene said, that the Red should not be the ones sheltering Elida, but should instead provide her fiercest critics. For Elida's legacy will be your own. Remember that. Katarine glanced at her, eyes flaring, and Egwene suppressed a cringe. Perhaps that last had been too straightforward. You will report to the Mistress of Novices tonight, child, Katarine informed her, and explain how you showed disrespect to sisters and to the Amyrlin herself. Egwene held her tongue. Why was she wasting her time trying to convince Reds? The aged wooden door behind her snapped shut, making Egwene jump and glance over her shoulder. The tapestries to either side stirred slightly, then went still. Egwene hadn't realized that she'd left the door open just a crack as she'd left. Had Sylviana listened to the conversation? There was no more time to dawdle. It appeared that Alviarin wasn't going to come this evening. Where was she? She always arrived for punishment right around the time that Egwene finished. Egwene shook her head, then strode away down the hallway. The two Reds followed. They stayed with her increasingly now, following her, watching her, at all times except when Egwene visited the quarters of other Ajahs for training. She tried to act as if those two sisters were an honorary retinue, rather than her jailers. She also tried to ignore the pain of her backside. All signs indicated that Egwene was winning her war against Elida. Earlier at lunch, Egwene had heard the novices gossiping about the dramatic failure Elida had suffered in failing to keep Rand captured. The event was several months past now, and was supposed to have been secret. And then there was the rumor of Ashaman bonding sisters who had been sent to destroy them. Another mission of Elida's that wasn't supposed to be known. Egwene had taken steps to keep these failures strong in the minds of the tower's occupants, much as she had with Elida's irregular treatment of Shemarin. Whatever the novices were gossiping about, the Aes Sedai were hearing. Yes, Egwene was winning, but she was beginning to lose the satisfaction she'd once felt at that victory. Who could take joy in seeing the Aes Sedai unraveling like aged canvas? Who could feel glad that Tar Valon, the grandest of all great cities, was piled with refuse? As much as Egwene might despise Elida, she could not exult at seeing an Amyrlin seat lead with such incompetence. And now, tonight, she would face Elida in person. Egwene walked slowly through the hallways, pacing herself so as to not arrive early. How should she proceed at the dinner? During her 9 days back in the tower, Egwene had not so much as glimpsed Elida. Attending the woman would be dangerous. If she offended Elida just a hair too much, she could find herself being sent for execution. And yet, she could not simper and pander. She would not bow before the woman. Not if it cost her life. Egwene turned a corner, then pulled up short, nearly stumbling. The hallway ended abruptly in a stonework wall set with a bright tile mural. The image was that of an ancient Amyrlin, sitting on an ornate golden seat, holding forth her hand in warning to the kings and queens of the land. The plaque at the bottom declared it to be a depiction of Carraigan Maconar, ending the rebellion in Mos Adorin. Egwene vaguely recognized the mural. The last she'd seen it, it had been on the wall of the tower library. But when she'd seen it there, the Amyrlin's face hadn't been a mask of blood. The dead bodies depicted hanging from the eaves hadn't been there either. Katarine stepped up beside Egwene, face paling. Nobody liked to speak of the unnatural way rooms and corridors changed places in the tower. The transformations made for a solemn reminder that squabbles over authority were secondary to larger, horrible troubles in the world. This was the first time Egwene had seen not only a corridor moved, but a depiction altered as well. The Dark One stirred, and the very pattern itself was shaking. Egwene turned and stalked away from the misplaced mural. She couldn't focus on those problems right now. You scrubbed a floor clean by first picking a single spot and getting to work. She'd picked her spot. The White Tower had to be made whole. Unfortunately, this detour was going to take more time. Egwene reluctantly hastened her pace. It wouldn't do to be early, but she'd prefer not to be late, either. Her two watchers hurried as well, skirts swishing as they backtracked through several corridors. As they did, Egwene caught sight of Alviarin hurrying around a corner, head down, walking toward the study of the Mistress of Novices. So she was going to her punishment after all. What had caused her to delay? Two more turns and one flight of cold stone steps later, Egwene found herself cutting through the red Aja section of the tower, as that now provided the quickest route up to the Ammerlin's quarters. Red tapestries hung on the walls, accented by crimson tiles on the floor. The women walking the corridors wore expressions of a near uniform austerity, their shawls draped carefully over their shoulders and arms. Here in their own Aja's quarters, where they should be confident, they seemed insecure and suspicious, even of those servants who bustled about, bearing the flame of Tarvalin on their chests. Egwene passed through the hallways, wishing she didn't have to hurry so, as it made her look cowed. There was nothing to be done about it. At the center of the tower, she climbed several flights of stairs, eventually reaching the hallway that led to the Ammerlin's quarters. Her busyness with novice chores and lessons had left her with little time to consider her confrontation with the false Ammerlin. This was the woman who had pulled down Suan, the woman who had beaten Rand, and the woman who had pushed the Aes Sedai themselves to the very brink of collapse. Elida needed to know Egwene's anger. She needed to be humiliated and made ashamed. Egwene stopped in front of Elida's gilded door. No. She could imagine the scene easily. Elida enraged. Egwene banished to the dark cells beneath the tower. What good would that do? She could not confront the woman. Not yet. That would only lead to momentary satisfaction followed by a debilitating failure. But like she couldn't bow to Elida either. The Ammerlin did no such thing. Or, no. The Ammerlin did what was required of her. Which was more important, the White Tower or Egwene's pride? The only way to win this battle was to let Elida think that she was winning. No. No, the only way to win was to let Elida think there was no battle. Could Egwene keep a civil tongue long enough to survive this night? She wasn't certain. However, she needed to leave this dinner with Elida feeling that she was in control, that Egwene was properly cowed. The best way to achieve that, while maintaining some measure of pride, would be to say nothing at all. Silence. That would be her weapon this evening. Steeling herself, Egwene knocked. Her first surprise came when an Aes Sedai opened the door. Didn't Elida have servants to perform that function? Egwene didn't recognize the sister, but the ageless face was obvious. The woman was of the gray, as indicated by her shawl, and she was slender with a full bust. Her golden brown hair fell to the middle of her back, and she had a haunted cast to her eyes, as if she'd been under great strain recently. Elida sat inside. Egwene hesitated in the doorway, looking in at her rival for the first time since departing from the White Tower with Nynaeve and Elaine to hunt the Black Aja, a turning point that seemed an eternity ago. Handsome and statuesque, Elida seemed to have lost a small measure of her sternness. She sat, secure and smiling faintly, as if thinking on some joke that only she understood. Her chair was almost a throne, carved, gilded, and painted with red and white. There was a second place set at the table, presumably for the nameless gray sister. Egwene had never visited an Ammerlin's own quarters before, but she could imagine what Suan's might have looked like. Simple, yet not stark. Just enough ornamentation to indicate that this was the room of someone important, but not enough to become a distraction. Under Suan, everything would have served a function, perhaps several functions at once. Tables with hidden compartments, wall hangings that doubled as maps, crossed swords over the hearth that were oiled, should the warders need them. Or perhaps that was just fancy. Regardless, not only had Elida taken different rooms for her quarters, her decorations were notably rich. The entire suite hadn't been decorated yet. There was talk that she was adding to her rooms day by day, but what was there was very lavish. New silk brocades, all of red, hung from the walls and ceilings. The Tyran rug underfoot depicted birds aflight, and was so finely woven that it could almost be mistaken for a painting. Scattered through the room were pieces of furniture of a dozen different styles and makes, each one lavishly carved and inlaid with ivory. Here a series of vines, there a knobby-ridged design, there crisscrossing serpents. More infuriating than the extravagance was the stole across Elida's shoulders. It was striped with six colors. Not seven, but six. Though Egwene had not chosen an Aja herself, she would have taken the green. But that didn't stop her from feeling a surge of anger at seeing that shawl with blue removed. One did not simply disband one of the Ajas, even if one were the Amarlin's seat. But Egwene held her tongue. This meeting was about survival. Egwene could bear straps of pain for the good of the tower. Could she bear Elida's arrogance as well? "No curtsy?" Elida asked as Egwene entered the room. "They said that you were stubborn. Well then, you shall visit the Mistress of Novices when this supper is through and inform her of the lapse. What do you say to that?"
"That you are a plague upon this structure as vile and destructive as any disease that has struck city and people in all years past. That you—"
Egwene broke her gaze away from Elida's.
And, feeling the shame of it vibrate through her very bones, she bowed her head.
Elida laughed, obviously taking the gesture the right way.
"Honestly, I expected you to be more troubled. It appears that Sylviana does know her duty. That is well. I'd worried that she, like far too many in the tower lately, had been shirking. Well, be busy with you. I won't wait all night to dine."
Egwene clenched her fists, but said nothing. The back wall was set with a long serving table bearing several silver platters, their polished domed lids dripping with condensation from the heated contents. There was also a silver soup tureen. To the side, the Grey Sister hovered near the door.
Light! The woman was terrified.
Egwene had rarely seen such an expression on a sister. What was causing it?
"Come, Maidani," Elida said to the Grey. "Are you going to hover all night? Sit down."
Egwene covered a moment of shock. Maidani? She was one of those sent by Shiriam and the others to spy on the White Tower.
As Egwene checked the contents of each platter, she shot a glance over her shoulder. Maidani had found her way to the small, less ornate seat at Elida's side. Did the Grey always wear such finery to supper? Her neck sparkled with emeralds, and her muted green dress was of the most expensive silk, accentuating a bosom that might have been average on another woman, but that seemed ample on Maidani's slender body. Beonin said she'd warned the Grey Sisters that Elida knew they were spies. So why hadn't Maidani fled the tower? What was holding her here? Well, at least now the woman's expression of terror made sense.
"Maidani," Elida said, sipping from a goblet of wine, "you are rather wan this day. Have you been getting enough sun?"
"I have been spending a great deal of time with historical records, Elida," Maidani said, voice uneven. "Have you forgotten?"
"Ah, that is right," Elida said musingly. "It will be good to know how traitors have been treated in the past. Beheading seems too easy and simple a punishment to me. Those who split our tower, those who flaunt their defection, a very special reward will be needed for them. Well, continue your search, then."
Maidani sat down, hands in lap. Anyone other than an Aes Sedai would have had to mop her brow free of sweat. Egwene stirred the silver tureen, hand clutching the ladle with a white-knuckled grip. Elida knew. She knew that Maidani was a spy, and yet she still invited the woman to dinner, to play with her.
"Hurry up, girl," Elida snapped at Egwene.
Egwene plucked up the tureen, the handles warm beneath her fingers, and walked over to the small table. She filled the bowls with a brownish broth bobbing with Queen's Crown mushrooms,
It smelled so heavily peppered that any other flavor would be indistinguishable. So much food had gone bad that without spice, the soup would be inedible. Egwene worked mechanically, like a wagon wheel rolling behind the oxen. She didn't have to make choices. She didn't have to respond. She just worked. She filled the soup bowls precisely, then fetched the bread basket and placed one piece, not too crusty, on each small porcelain bread saucer. She returned with a circular dab of butter for each, cut quickly but precisely from the larger brick with a couple of flicks of the knife. One did not spend long as an innkeeper's daughter without learning to serve a proper meal. Even as she worked, she stewed. Each step was agony, and not because of her still burning backside. That physical pain, oddly, seemed insignificant now. It was secondary to the pain of remaining silent, the pain of not allowing herself to confront this awful woman, so regal, so arrogant. As the two women began their soup, pointedly ignoring the weevils in their bread, Egwene retreated to the side of the room and stood, hands clasped before her, posture stiff. Elida glanced at her, then smiled, apparently seeing another sign of subservience. In reality, Egwene didn't trust herself to move, for she feared that any activity would end with her slapping Elida across the face. Light, but this was hard. "What talk is there in the tower, Medani?" Elida asked, dipping her bread in the soup.
"I don't have much time to listen."
Elida leaned forward. "Oh, surely you know something. You have ears, and even greys must gossip. What are they saying about these rebels?"
Medani paled further.
"'Hmm," Elida said. "When we were novices, I don't remember you being so slow of wit, Medani. You haven't impressed me these last few weeks. I begin to wonder why you were ever given the shawl. Perhaps it never belonged on your shoulders in the first place."
Medani's eyes opened wide.
Elida smiled at her. "Oh, I'm only teasing you, child. Back to your meal."
She joked.
Joked about how she had stolen the shawl from a woman, humiliating her to such an extent that she fled the tower. Light! What had happened to Elida? Egwene had met this woman before, and Elida had struck her as stern but not tyrannical. Power changed people. It appeared that in Elida's case, holding the Ammerlin seat had taken her sternness and solemnity and replaced them with a heady sense of entitlement and cruelty.
Medani looked up. I have heard sisters express worry about the Seanchan.
Elida waved an indifferent hand, sipping her soup. Bah! They are too distant to be of danger to us. I wonder if they're secretly working for the Dragon Reborn. Either way, I suspect that the rumors about them are largely exaggerated. Elida glanced at Egwene. It's a source of constant amusement to me that some will believe anything that they hear. Egwene couldn't speak. She could barely have sputtered. How would Elida feel about these exaggerated rumors if the Seanchan slapped a cold Adam around her idiot neck? Egwene could sometimes feel that band on her own skin itching, impossible to move. Sometimes it still made her faintly sick to move around freely, as if she felt that she should be locked away, chained to the post on the wall by a simple loop of metal. She knew what she had dreamed, and knew those dreams to be prophetic. The Seanchan would strike at the White Tower itself. Elida, obviously, discounted her warnings. "No," Elida said, waving for Egwene to bring another ladle of soup. "These Seanchan are not the problem. The real danger is the complete lack of obedience shown by the Aes Sedai. What will I have to do to end those foolish talks at the bridges? How many sisters will have to do penance before they acknowledge my authority?" She sat, tapping her spoon against her soup cup. Egwene at the serving table picked up the tureen, retrieving the ladle from its silver holder. "Yes," Elida mused. "If the sisters had been obedient, then the tower wouldn't be divided. Those rebels would have obeyed rather than running off like a silly flock of startled birds. If the sisters were obedient, we would have the dragon reborn in our hands, and those horrid men training in their black tower would have been dealt with long ago. What do you think, Medani?
Obedience is certainly important, Elida.
Elida shook her head as Egwene ladled soup into her bowl. Anyone would admit that, Medani. I asked what should be done. Fortunately, I have an idea myself. Doesn't it strike you as strange that the three oaths contain no mention of obedience to the White Tower? Sisters cannot lie, cannot make a weapon for men to kill other men, and cannot use the power as a weapon against others except in defense. Those oaths have always seemed too lax to me. Why no oath to obey the Ammerlin? If that simple promise were part of all of us, how much pain and difficulty could we have avoided? Perhaps some revision is in order.
Egwene stood still.
Once she herself hadn't understood the importance of the oaths. She suspected that many a novice and accepted had questioned their usefulness. But she had learned, as every Aes Sedai must, their importance. The three oaths were what made the Aes Sedai. They were what kept the Aes Sedai doing what was best for the world. But more than that, they were a shelter from accusations. Changing them? Well, it would be an unprecedented disaster. Elida should know that. The false Ammerlin just turned back to her soup, smiling to herself, no doubt contemplating a fourth oath to demand obedience. Couldn't she see how that would undermine the tower itself? It would transform the Ammerlin from a leader to a despot. Egwene's rage boiled within her, steaming like the soup in her hands. This woman, this creature, she was the cause of the problems in the White Tower. She was the one who caused division between rebels and loyalists. She had taken Rand captive and beaten him. She was a disaster. Egwene felt herself shaking. In another moment, she'd burst and let Elida hear truth. It was boiling free from her, and she could barely contain it. No, she thought. If I do that, my battle ends. I lose my war. So Egwene did the only thing she could think of to stop herself. She dumped the soup on the floor. Brownish liquid sprayed across the delicate rug of red, yellow, and green birds aflight. Elida cursed, jumping up from her seat and backing away from the spill. None of the liquid had gotten on her dress, which was a shame. Egwene calmly snatched a serving towel off of the table and began to mop up the spill. "You clumsy idiot!" Elida snapped. "I'm sorry," Egwene said. "I wish that hadn't happened." And she did. She wished none of this evening had occurred. She wished Elida weren't in control. She wished the tower had never been broken. She wished she hadn't been forced to spill the soup on the floor. But she had. And so she dealt with it, kneeling and scrubbing. Elida sputtered, pointing. "That rug is worth more than your entire village, Wilder. Medani, help her." The Grey didn't offer a single objection. She scurried over and grabbed a bucket of chilled water which had been cooling some wine and hurried back to help Egwene. Elida moved over to a door on the far side of the room to call for servants.
"Send for me,"
Egwene whispered, as Medani knelt down to help clean.
"What?"
"Send for me to give me instruction," Egwene said quietly, glancing at Elida, whose back was turned.
"We need to speak."
Egwene had originally intended to avoid the Saladar spies, letting Baonin act as her messenger. But she had too many questions. Why hadn't Medani fled the tower? What were the spies planning? Had any of the others been adopted by Elida and beaten down as soundly as Medani? Medani glanced at Elida, then back at Egwene. "I may not seem it sometimes, but I'm still Aes Sedai, girl. You cannot order me." "I am your Ammerlin, Medani," Egwene said calmly, wringing a towel full of soup into a pitcher. "And you would do best to remember it." unless you want the three oaths replaced with vows to serve Elida for eternity. Medani glanced at her, then cringed at Elida's shrill calls for servants. The poor woman had obviously seen a hard time lately. Egwene laid a hand on her shoulder. Elida can be unseated, Medani. The tower will be reunited. I will see it happen, but we must keep courage. Send for me. Medani looked up, studying Egwene. How do you do it? They say you're punished 3 and 4 times a day, that you need healing between so that they can beat you further. How can you take it? I take it because I must, Egwene said, lowering her hand. Just as we all do what we must. Your service here watching Elida is difficult, I can see, but know that your work is noticed and appreciated. Egwene didn't know if Medani really had been sent to spy on Elida, but it was always better for a woman to think that her suffering was for a good purpose. It seemed to have been the right thing to say, for Medani straightened, taking heart and nodding. Thank you. Elida was returning, behind her 3 servants. Send for me, Egwene ordered Medani again, voice a whisper. I am one of the few in this tower who has a good excuse to move between the various Aja quarters. I can help heal what has been broken, but I will need your help. Medani hesitated, then nodded. Very well. You, Elida snapped, stepping up to Egwene. Out! I want you to tell Sylviana to strap you as she's never strapped a woman before. I want her to punish you, then heal you on the spot, then beat you again. Go! Egwene stood, handing her towel to one of the servants. Then she walked to the exit. And don't think that your clumsiness has allowed you to escape your duties, Elida continued from behind. You will return and serve me again on another date. And if you so much as spill another drop, I will have you locked away in a cell with no windows or lights for a week, do you understand? Egwene left the room. Had this woman ever been a true Aes Sedai, in control of her emotions? Yet Egwene herself had lost control of her emotions. She should never have let herself get to a point where she'd been forced to drop the soup. She had underestimated how infuriating Elida could be, but that would not happen again. She calmed herself as she walked, breathing in and out. Rage did her no good. You didn't get mad at the weasel who was sneaking into your yard and eating your hens. You simply laid a trap and disposed of the animal. Anger was pointless. Hands still smelling faintly of pepper and spices, she made her way down to the lowest level of the tower, to the novices' dining hall beside the main kitchens. Egwene had worked in those kitchens herself frequently during the last 9 days. Every novice was required to work chores. The smells of the place, charcoal and smoke, simmering soups, and sharp, unscented soaps, were very familiar to her. The smells weren't that different, actually, from the kitchen of her father's inn back in the Two Rivers. The white-walled room was empty, the tables sitting unattended, though there was a small tray on one of them, covered with a pot lid to keep it warm. Her cushion was there as well, left by the novices to soften the hard bench. Egwene approached, but ignored the cushion as she always did, though she was grateful for the gesture. She sat and removed the lid from the meal. Unfortunately, all she found was a bowl of the same brownish soup. There was no hint of the roast, gravy, or long, thin, buttered beans that had made up the rest of Elida's meal. Still, it was food, and Egwene's stomach was grateful for it. Elida hadn't ordered that she immediately go for punishment, and so Sylviana's order that she eat first took precedence. Or, at least, there was enough of an argument there to protect her. She ate quietly, alone. The soup was indeed spicy, and it tasted as much of pepper as it had smelled, but she didn't mind. Other than that, it was actually quite good. She'd also been left a few slices of bread, though she'd gotten the ends of the loaf. All in all, not a bad meal for someone who had thought she might get nothing. Egwene ate contemplatively, listening to Laris and the scullions bang pots at washing up in the other room, surprised at how calm she felt. She had changed.
Something was different about her. Watching Elida, finally confronting the woman who had been her rival all of these months, forced her to look at what she was doing in a new light. She had imagined herself undermining Elida and seizing control of the White Tower from within. Now she realized that she didn't need to undermine Elida. The woman was fully capable of doing that herself. Why, Egwene could picture the reactions of the sitters and Aja heads when Elida announced her intention to change the three oaths. Elida would topple eventually, with or without Egwene's help. Egwene's duty as Amyrlin wasn't to speed that fall, but to do whatever she could to hold the tower and its occupants together. They couldn't afford to fracture further. Her duty was to hold back the chaos and destruction that threatened them all, to reforge the tower. As she finished off her soup, using the last piece of bread to wipe the remnants from the bowl, she realized she had to do whatever she could to be a strength to the sisters in the tower. Time was growing very short. What was Rand doing to the world without guidance? When would the Seanchan attack to the north? They'd have to cut through Andor to get to Tar Valon. And what destruction would that cause? Surely she had some time to reforge the tower before the attack came, but no moments to waste. Egwene took her dish into the kitchen proper and washed it herself, earning a nod of approval from the hefty mistress of the kitchens. After that, Egwene made her way up to Sylviana's study. She needed to get her punishment done quickly. She still intended to visit Lyanna tonight, as was her custom. Egwene knocked, then entered, finding Sylviana at her desk, leafing through a thick tome by the light of two silver lamps. When Egwene entered, Sylviana marked the page with a small length of red cloth, then shut it. The worn cover read, "Meditations on the Kindling Flame, a history of the rise of various Amyrlins. Curious." Egwene sat down on a stool before the desk, not flinching at the immediate sharp pain of her backside, and spoke calmly about the evening, omitting the fact that she'd dropped the bowl of soup on purpose. She did, however, say that she'd dropped it after Elida had talked of revoking and changing the three oaths. Sylviana looked very thoughtful at that. "Well," the woman said, standing up and fetching her lash, "the Amyrlin has spoken." "Yes, I have," Egwene said, standing up and positioning herself on the table, skirts and shift up for the beating. Sylviana hesitated, and then the strapping began. Oddly, Egwene felt no desire to cry out. It hurt, of course, but she just couldn't scream. How ridiculous the punishment was. She remembered her pain at seeing the sisters pass in the hallways, regarding one another with fear, suspicion, and distrust. She remembered the agony of serving Elida while holding her tongue, and she remembered the sheer horror at the idea of everyone in the tower being bound by oath to obey such a tyrant. Egwene remembered her pity for poor Medani. No sister should be treated in such a way. Imprisonment was one thing, but beating a woman down, toying with her, hinting at the torture to come, it was insufferable. Each of these things was a pain inside of Egwene, a knife to the chest, piercing the heart. As the beating continued, she realized that nothing else they could do to her body would ever compare to the pain of soul she felt at seeing the White Towers suffer beneath Elida's hand. Compared with those internal agonies, the beating was ridiculous. And so she began to laugh. It wasn't a forced laugh. It wasn't a defiant laugh. It was the laughter of disbelief, of incredulity. How could they think that beating her would solve anything? It was ludicrous. The lashing stopped. Egwene turned. Surely that wasn't all of it. Sylviana was regarding her with a concerned expression. "Child," she asked, "are you all right?"
"I'm quite well."
"You are certain? How are your thoughts?"
"She thinks I've broken under the strain," Egwene realized. "She beats me and I laugh from it."
"My thoughts are well," Egwene said. "I don't laugh because I've been broken, Sylviana. I laugh because it is absurd to beat me." The woman's expression darkened.
"Can't you see it?" Egwene asked. "Don't you feel the pain? The agony of watching the tower crumble around you? Could any beating compare to that? Sylviana did not respond.
I understand, Egwene thought. I didn't realize what the Aiel did. I assumed that I just had to be harder, and that was what would teach me to laugh at pain. But it's not hardness at all. It's not strength that makes me laugh. It's understanding. To let the tower fall, to let the Aes Sedai fail, the pain of that would destroy her. She had to stop it, for she was the Ammerlin Seat. I cannot refuse to punish you, Sylviana said. You realize that?
Of course, Egwene said. But please remind me of something. What was it you said about Shemarin? Why was it Elida got away with taking the shawl from her?
It was because Shemarin accepted it, Sylviana replied. She treated herself as if she really had lost the shawl. She didn't fight back.
I will not make the same mistake, Sylviana. Elida can say whatever she wants, but that doesn't change who I am, or who any of us are. Even if she tries to change the three oaths, there will be those who resist, who hold to what is correct. And so, when you beat me, you beat the Ammerlin Seat, and that should be amusing enough to make us both laugh. The punishment continued, and Egwene embraced the pain, took it into herself, and judged it insignificant, impatient for the punishment to cease. She had a lot of work to do. Chapter 3. The Ways of Honor. Avienda crouched with her spear sisters and some true blood scouts atop the low grassy hill, looking down at the refugees. They were a sorry lot, these Damani wetlanders, with dirtied faces that had not seen a sweat tent in months, their emaciated children too hungry to cry. One sad mule pulled a single cart among the hundred struggling people. What they hadn't piled in the vehicle, they carried. There wasn't much of either. They plodded northeast along a pathway that couldn't quite be called a road. Perhaps there was a village in that direction. Perhaps they were just fleeing the uncertainty of the coastal lands. The hilly landscape was open, save for the occasional stand of trees. The refugees hadn't seen Avienda and her companions, despite the fact that they were less than 100 paces away. She'd never understood how wetlanders could be so blind. Didn't they watch, noting any oddities on the horizon? Couldn't they see that traveling so near to a hilltop practically invited scouts to spy on them? They should have secured the hill with their own scouts before coming anywhere near. Didn't they care? Avienda shivered. How could you not care about eyes watching you, eyes that might belong to a man or maiden holding a spear? Were they so eager to wake from the dream? Avienda did not fear death, but there was a very big difference between embracing death and wishing for it. Cities, she thought, they're the problem. Cities were stinking, festering places like sores that never healed. Some were better than others. Elaine did an admirable job with Camelin, but the best of them gathered too many people and taught them to grow comfortable staying in one place. If those refugees had been accustomed to travel and had learned to use their own feet, rather than relying on horses, as wetlanders so often did, then it would not be so difficult for them to leave their towns. Among the Aiel, the craftsmen were trained to defend themselves, the children could live off the land for days, and even blacksmiths could travel great distances quickly. An entire sept could be on the move within an hour, carrying everything they needed on their backs. Wetlanders were strange, doubtless. Still, she felt pity for the refugees. The emotion surprised her. While she was not heartless, her duty lay elsewhere, with Randall Thor. She had no reason to feel heartsore for a group of wetlanders she'd never met. But time spent with her first sister, Elaine Trakand, had taught her that not all wetlanders were soft and weak. Just most of them. There was G. in caring for those who could not care for themselves. Watching these refugees, Avienda tried to see them as Elaine would, but she still struggled to understand Elaine's form of leadership. It was not the simple leadership of a group of maidens on a raid. That was both instinctive and efficient. Elaine would not watch these refugees for signs of danger or hidden soldiers. Elaine would feel a responsibility to them, even if they were not of her own people. She would find a way to send food, perhaps use her troops to secure a safe place for them to homestead, and, in doing so, acquire a piece of this country for herself. Once, Aviendo would have left these thoughts to clan chiefs and roof mistresses. But she wasn't a maiden any longer, and she had accepted that. She now lived under a different roof. She was ashamed that she had resisted the change for so long. But that left her with a problem. What honor was there for her now? No longer a maiden, not quite a wise one. Her entire identity had been wrapped up in those spears, herself forged into their steel as surely as the carbon that strengthened them. She had grown from childhood certain that she would be far Darais Mai. Indeed, she had joined the maidens as soon as possible. She had been proud of her life and of her spear sisters. She would have served her clan and sept until the day when she finally fell to the spear, bleeding her last water onto the parched earth of the Threefold Land. This was not the Threefold Land, and she had heard some Algai de Siswai wonder if the Aiel would ever return there. Their lives had changed. She didn't trust change. It couldn't be spotted or stabbed. It was more silent than any scout, more deadly than any assassin. No, she'd never trust it. But she would accept it. She would learn Elaine's ways and how to think like a chief. She would find honor in her new life. Somehow.
"They are no threat,"
whispered Hyrn, crouching with the True Bloods on the other side of the maidens. Ruark watched the refugees, alert.
"The dead walk," the Tardad clan chief said. "And men fall at random to sight-blinders evil, their blood corrupted like the water of a bad well. Those might be poor folk fleeing the ravages of war, or they might be something else. We keep our distance."
Avienda glanced at the increasingly distant line of refugees. She did not think Ruark was right. These were not ghosts or monsters. There was always something wrong about those. They left her with an itch, as if she were about to be attacked. Still, Ruark was wise. One learned to be careful in the Threefold Land, where a tiny twig could kill. The group of Aiel slipped off the hilltop and down onto the brown-grassed plain beyond. Even after months spent in the wetlands, Avienda found the landscape strange. Trees here were tall and long-limbed, with too many buds. When the Aiel crossed patches of yellow spring grass among the fallen winter leaves, they all seemed so full of water that she half expected the blades and leaves to burst beneath her feet. She knew the wetlanders said that this spring was unnaturally slow starting, but already it was more fertile than her homeland. In the Threefold Land, this meadow, with the hills to provide watchpoints and shelter, would have immediately been seized by a sept and used for farming. Here, it was just one of a thousand different untouched patches of land. The fault lay again in those cities. The nearest ones were too distant from this location to make it a good spot for a wetland or farmstead. The eight Aiel quickly crossed the grasses, weaving between hillsides, moving with speed and stealth. Horses could not match a man's feet, what with their thunderous galloping. Terrible beasts! Why did the wetlanders insist on riding them? Baffling. Avienda could begin to understand how a chief or queen must think, but she knew that she'd never completely understand wetlanders. They were just too strange. Even Randall Thor. Especially Randall Thor. She smiled, thinking of his earnest eyes. She remembered the scent of him. Wetlander soaps, which smelled of oil, mixed with that particular earthy musk that was all his own. She would marry him. She was as determined as Elaine in that regard. Now that they were first sisters, they could marry him together as was proper. Only how could Avienda marry anyone now? Her honor had been in her spears, but Randall Thor now wore those at his waist, beaten and forged into a belt buckle, given to him by her own hand. He had offered her marriage once.
A man offering marriage. Another of those strange wetlander customs. Even disregarding the strangeness of it, disregarding the insult his proposal had shown Elaine, Avienda could never have accepted Randall Thor as her husband. Couldn't he understand that a woman must bring honor to a marriage? What could a mere apprentice offer? Would he have her come to him as an inferior? It would shame her completely to do that. He must not have understood. She did not think him cruel, only dense. She would come to him when she was ready, then lay the bridal wreath at his feet, and she couldn't do that until she knew who she was. The ways of Je et To were complex. Avienda knew how to measure honor as a maiden, but wise ones were different creatures entirely. She had thought she was gaining some small amount of honor in their eyes. They had allowed her, for instance, to spend a great deal of time with her first sister in Camelin. But then, suddenly, Dorinda and Nadir had arrived and informed Avienda that she had been ignoring her training. They had seized her like a child caught listening furtively outside the sweat tent, towing her away to join the rest of her clan as they left for Arad Doman. And now the wise ones treated her with less respect than they had before. They offered her no teaching. Somehow she had misstepped in their eyes. That made her stomach twist. To shame herself before the other wise ones was almost as bad as showing fear before one as brave as Elaine. So far the wise ones had allowed Avienda some honor by letting her serve punishments. But she didn't know how she had shamed herself in the first place. Asking would, of course, only bring more shame. Until she unwove the problem, she could not meet her toe. Worse, there was a real danger of her making the mistake again. Until she sorted out this problem, she would remain an apprentice, and she would never be able to bring an honorable bridal wreath to Randall Thor. Avienda gritted her teeth. Another woman might have wept. But what good would that have done? Whatever her mistake, she had brought it upon herself, and it was her duty to right it. She would find honor again, and she would marry Randall Thor before he died at the last battle. That meant that whatever it was she had to learn, she needed to do so quickly. Very quickly. They met up with another group of Aiel, waiting in a small clearing amid a stand of pine trees. The ground was thick with discarded brown needles, the sky broken by the towering trunks. The group was small by the standards of clans and septs, barely 200 people. In the middle of the clearing stood four wise ones, each wearing the characteristic brown woolen skirt and white blouse. Avienda wore similar attire, which now felt as natural to her as the Cadensor once had. The scouting party split up, men and maidens moving to join members of their clans or societies. Ruark joined the wise ones, and Avienda followed him. Each of the wise ones, Amis, Bear, Milane, and Nadir, gave her a glance. Bear, the only Aiel with the group who wasn't Tardad or Goshin, had arrived only recently, perhaps to coordinate with the others. Whatever the reason, none of them seemed pleased. Avienda hesitated. If she left now, would it seem as if she were trying to avoid their attention? Did she instead dare stay and risk incurring their further displeasure? Well, Amis said to Ruark. Though Amis had white hair, she looked quite young. In her case, this wasn't due to working the power. Her hair had started turning silver when she'd been a child.
It was as the scouts described, shade of my heart, Ruark said. Another pitiful band of wetlander refugees. I saw no hidden danger in them.
The wise ones nodded, as if this was what they had expected.
That is the 10th band of refugees in less than a week, said aged Bear, her watery blue eyes thoughtful.
Ruark nodded. There are rumors of Shonshan attacks on harbors to the west. Perhaps the people move inland to avoid the raids.
He glanced at Amis.
This country boils like water spilled on a hearthstone. The clans are uncertain what Rand Althor wishes of them.
He was very clear, Bear noted. He will be pleased that you and Dobrain Taborwin secured Bandar Ebon, as he asked.
Ruark nodded.
but still his intentions are not clear. He asked for us to restore order. Are we then to be like Wetlander City Guardsmen? That is no place for the Aiel. We are not to conquer, so we do not get the fifth. And yet it feels very much like conquest, what we do. The Karakarn's orders can be clear, yet confusing at the same time. He has a gift in that area, I think.
Bear smiled, nodding. Perhaps he intends for us to do something with these refugees.
And what would we do? Amis asked, shaking her head. Are we, Shido, expected to make Gaishine from Wetlanders?
Her tone left little doubt as to what she thought of both Shido and the idea of making Wetlanders Gaishine.
Avienda nodded in agreement. As Ruark said, the Karakarn had sent them to Arad-Domon to restore order. But that was a Wetlander concept. Aiel brought their own order with them. There was chaos to war and battle, true, but each and every Aiel understood his place and would act within that place. The little children understood honor and to, and a hold would continue to function after all of the leaders and wise ones were killed. It was not so with Wetlanders. They ran about like a basket of wild lizards suddenly dropped onto hot stones, taking no care for provisions when they fled. As soon as their leaders were occupied or distracted, banditry and chaos ruled. The strong took from the weak, and even blacksmiths were not safe. What could Randall Thor expect the Aiel to do about it? They could not teach Je-Eto to an entire nation. Randall Thor had told them to avoid killing Damani troops, but those troops, often corrupt and turned to banditry themselves, were part of the problem.
"Perhaps ye will explain more when we arrive at this manor house of his," said Milane, shaking her head, red-gold hair catching the light. Her pregnancy was just beginning to show beneath her wise one blouse. "And if he does not, then surely it is better for us to be here in Arad-Domon than to spend yet more time lounging back in the land of the tree-killers."
"As you say," Ruark agreed. "Let us move on, then. There is still a distance to run."
He moved off to speak with Bale. Avienda took a step away, but a harsh glance from Amis made her freeze.
"Avienda," said the hard, white-haired woman. "How many wise ones went with Ruark to scout this refugee train?"
"None but me," Avienda admitted.
"Oh, and are you a wise one now?" Bear asked.
"No," Avienda said quickly, then shamed herself further by blushing. "I spoke poorly."
"Then you shall be punished," Bear said. "You are no longer a maiden, Avienda. It is not your place to scout. That is a task for others."
"Yes, wise one," Avienda said, looking down.
She had not thought that going with Ruark would bring her shame. She had seen other wise ones do similar tasks.
"But I am not a wise one," she reminded herself. "I am an apprentice only."
Bear had not said that a wise one could not scout, only that it had not been Avienda's place to go. It was about Avienda herself, and about whatever it was she had done, or perhaps continued to do, to provoke the wise ones. Did they think she had grown soft by spending time with Elaine? Avienda herself worried that that was true. During her days in Camelin, she had begun to find herself enjoying the silks and baths. By the end, she had objected only feebly when Elaine had come up with an excuse to dress her in some impractical and frivolous garment with embroidery and lace. It was well that the others had come for her. The others just stood there, looking at her expectantly, faces like red desert stones, impassive and stern. Avienda gritted her teeth again. She would complete her apprenticeship and find honor. She would! The call came to begin moving, and Cadensor-clad men and women did so, running together in small groups. The wise ones moved as easily as the soldiers, despite their bulky skirts. Amis touched Avienda's arm. "You will run with me so that we can discuss your punishment."
Avienda fell into pace beside the Wise One at a brisk jog. It was a speed any Aiel could maintain almost indefinitely. Her group from Camelin had met up with Ruark as he was traveling from Bandar Eban to meet with Randall Thor in the western part of the country. Dobrain Taborwin, a Kyrianin, was still maintaining order in the capital city, where he'd reportedly located a member of the Damani ruling body. Perhaps the group of Aiel could have traveled through a gateway the rest of the distance, but it was not far, only a few days by foot, and they had left early enough to arrive at the appointed time without using the One Power. Ruark wanted to scout for himself some of the landscape near the manor house Randall Thor was using as a base. Other bodies of Goshin or Tardad Aiel would join them at the base, using gateways if needed. "What do you think of the Karakhan's demands of us here in Arad Doman, Avienda?" Amis asked as they ran. Avienda stifled a frown. What of her punishment? "It is an irregular request," she said. "But Randall Thor has many strange ideas, even for a wetlander. This will not be the most unusual duty he has set for us." "And the fact that Ruark finds the duty discomforting?" "I doubt that the clan chief is uncomfortable," Avienda said. "I suspect that Ruark speaks what he has heard others say, passing the information to the Wise Ones. He does not wish to shame others by revealing who has spoken of their fears." Amis nodded. What was the purpose of the questions? Surely the woman had guessed the same thing. She would not come to Avienda for counsel. They ran in silence for a time with no mentions of punishments. Had the Wise Ones forgiven her unknown slight? Surely they wouldn't dishonor her in that way. Avienda had to be given time to think out what she had done, otherwise her shame would be unbearable. She might err again, this time worse. Amis gave no clue as to her thoughts. The Wise One had been a maiden once, like Avienda. She was hard, even for an Aiel. "And Althor himself?" Amis asked. "What do you think of him?"
"I love him," Avienda said.
"I did not ask Avienda the silly girl," Amis said curtly. "I asked Avienda the Wise One."
"He is a man of many burdens," Avienda said more carefully. "I fear that he makes many of those burdens heavier than they need be. I once thought that there was only one way to be strong, but I have learned from my first sister that I was wrong. Randall Thor, I do not think he has learned this yet. I worry that he mistakes hardness for strength."
Amis nodded again as if in approval. Were these questions a test of some sort?
"You would marry him?" Amis asked.
I thought we weren't talking about Avienda the silly girl, Avienda thought, but of course didn't say it. One did not say such things to Amis.
"I will marry him," she said instead. "It is not a possibility, but a certainty." The tone earned her a glance from Amis, but Avienda held her ground. Any Wise One who misspoke deserved to be corrected.
"And the wetlander, Min Farshaw?" Amis asked. "She obviously loves him. What will you do about her?"
"She is my concern," Avienda said. "We will reach an accommodation. I have spoken with Min Farshaw, and I believe she will be easy to work with."
"You would become first sisters with her as well?" Amis asked, sounding just faintly amused.
"We will reach an accommodation, Wise One, and if you cannot, we will," Avienda said firmly.
"And how can you be so certain?"
Avienda hesitated. Part of her wished to return only silence to that question, passing the leafless brush thickets and giving Amis no answer. But she was just an apprentice, and while she could not be forced to speak, she knew that Amis would keep pushing until the answer came out. Avienda hoped she would not incur too much to by her response.
"You know of the woman Min's viewings?" Avienda said.
Amis nodded.
"One of those viewings relates to Randall Thor and the three women he will love. Another relates to my children by the Karakarn."
She said no more, and Amis pressed no more. It was enough. Both knew that one would sooner find a stone dog who would retreat than find a viewing of Min's that went wrong. On the one hand, it was good to know that Randall Thor would be hers, although she would have to share him. She did not begrudge Elaine, of course, but Min... Well, Avienda did not really know her. Regardless, the viewing was a comfort, but it was also bothersome. Avienda loved Randall Thor because she chose to, not because she was destined to. Of course, Min's viewing didn't guarantee that Avienda would actually be able to marry Rand, so perhaps she had misspoken to Amis. Yes, he would love three women and three women would love him, but would Avienda find a way to marry him? No, the future was not certain, and for some reason that brought her comfort. Perhaps she should have worried, but she did not. She would get her honor back, and then she would marry Randall Thor. Perhaps he would die soon after, but perhaps an ambush would come and she would fall to an arrow this day. Worrying solved nothing. To, however, was another matter. I misspoke, wise one, Avienda said. I implied that the viewing said I would marry Randall Thor. That is not true. All three of us will love him, and while that implies marriage, I do not know for certain. Amis nodded. There was no To. Avienda had corrected herself quickly enough. That was well. She would not add more shame on top of what she had already earned. Very well, then, Amis said, watching the path ahead of her. Let us discuss today's punishment. Avienda relaxed slightly. So she still had time to discover what she had done wrong. Wetlanders often seemed confused by Aiel ways with punishment, but Wetlanders had little understanding of honor. Honor didn't come from being punished, but accepting a punishment and bearing it restored honor. That was the soul of To, the willing lowering of oneself in order to recover that which had been lost. It was strange to her that Wetlanders couldn't see this. Indeed, it was strange that they didn't follow Je et To instinctively. What was life without honor? Amis, rightly, wouldn't tell Avienda what she had done wrong. However, she was having no success thinking through the answer on her own, and it would cause less shame if she discovered the answer through conversation. Yes, Avienda said carefully. I should be punished. My time in Camelin threatened to make me weak. Amis sniffed. You are no more weak than you were when you carried the spears, girl. A fair bit stronger, I should think. Your time with your first sister was important for you. So that wasn't it. When Durinda and Nadir had come for her, they had said she needed to continue her training as an apprentice. Yet in the time since the Aiel had departed for Arad Domann, Avienda had been given no lessons. She had been assigned to carry water, to mend shawls, and to serve tea. She had been given all manner of punishments with little explanation of what she had done wrong. And when she did something obvious, like going scouting when she shouldn't have, the severity of her punishment was always greater than the infraction should have merited. It was almost as if the punishment was the thing the wise ones wanted her to learn. But that could not be. She was not some Wetlander who needed to be taught the ways of honor. What good would constant and unexplained punishment do, other than to warn of some grave mistake she had made? Amis reached to her side, untying something hanging at her waist. The woolen bag she held up was about the size of a fist. "We have decided," she said, "that we have been too lax in our instruction. Time is precious and we have no room left for delicacy." Avienda covered her surprise. Their previous punishments were delicate? "Therefore," Amis said, handing over the small sack, "you will take this. Inside are seeds. Some are black, others are brown, others are white. This evening, before we sleep, you will separate